Du lytter til Radio Rackham.
Vi har stjernebesøg i dag i Radio Rackham. Vi har besøg af ingen ringere end Sara Andersen, eller bedre kendt som Sara Andersen, kvinden bag Sarah Scribbles, kæmpe fænomen på Instagram, over 4 millioner følgere, en af de allerstørste moderne tegneserietegnere, vi overhovedet har. Og velkommen til dig, vi er glade for at have dig.
Thank you for having me.
Og som I hørte, der er talt lidt på engelsk. Vi kommer til at skifte til engelsk ret hurtigt i den her udsendelse, for dagens tema er nemlig AI. Sara er nemlig en del af et sagsanlæg mod firmaerne bag de store AI-systemer, Midjourney, Stability, Deviant AI og Runway. En sag, der kører i øjeblikket, og som udvikler sig hele tiden. Vi skal dykke dybt ned i den og høre om problematikkerne. Vi har før talt om det i Radio Rackham. Kan høre udsendelsen i vores bagkatalog. Men lad os sige velkommen, og i studiet har vi foruden Sara Andersen, Mathias Wivel, og jeg selv hedder Thomas Thorhauge. Og Sara, welcome and thank you so much for being here today.
Of course, I'm so happy to be here.
Would you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Sara Andersen, and I usually call myself a cartoonist. I do some illustration, but I'm mainly known for the series Sarah Scribbles, but I have other series as well, Fangs and Cryptid Club.
And you're also a little bit Danish.
Yes, I'm half Danish.
can you perhaps in Danish explain your family connection to Denmark?
Yeah, min far dansk, og jeg snakker dansk med min far. Og jeg er også citizen. Jeg ved ikke, hvad det er, man siger.
Statsborger.
Statsborger på Danmark, ja.
Ja, og du har været her ret tit i dine endnu yngre dage.
Ja, ja, og jeg prøver at komme en gang om året eller mere, fordi ja, jeg føler stadigvæk dansk, men jeg ved, at man kan høre nu, at jeg har en amerikansk.
Du er fra Brooklyn.
Accent. Ja, ja, præcis. Ja. Men ja, jeg voksede op. Jeg snakkede altid dansk med min far, og vi besøgte altid Danmark, så det er en del af mit liv, og ja, del af min hjerte.
Det er fantastisk, og vi har alligevel valgt at lave den her udsendelse på engelsk, fordi vi skal dykke ned i The Plaintiff.
Si, yes.
Og,
sorry, I speak Spanish.
And
that was so embarrassing. oh my gosh.
But before we get to the case, before we get to AI, which is the subject of the day, perhaps tell us a little bit about how you ended up doing cartoons.
Yes. So I went to art school. You know, I actually applied to the Royal Academy here and did not get in.
So
my accent would have been a lot better if I had succeeded with that. But I went to art school with the intention of becoming a children's book illustrator or an editorial illustrator. And while I was there, I had a blog and I posted all my work. And I had always really loved comics and had always made them, but didn't think I was good enough to be a cartoonist. So sometimes I would post these little doodles on the blog I was keeping for my artwork. And I noticed that the comics always received a lot more attention, even though they were very basic. So
when was this?
Around 2011.
Okay.
And you know, you probably know this, but in art school, the pressure is on. They basically tell you you're going to fail unless you try really, really hard to succeed. So the second I saw something that worked, I was like, I'm going to be a cartoonist. People like this. I can do this. And I just spent the next 3 years working on it while I was at school.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when did you feel you had the major breakthrough?
Yeah.
When was this and how did that happen?
For me, it was, I think now you don't necessarily need a book deal to be successful or recognized. But for me back then, I felt like there was still a gap between online comics and published newspaper comics. So when I got my first book deal, I believe I signed the deal in 2015 and then the book came out 2016. It was at that point that I felt like a real cartoonist.
And was that Adulthood is a Myth?
Yes.
Yes, which we also have in Danish. Den kom jo på dansk, hedder Voksenlivet er en myte på forlaget Kobold, og oversat af din væsenbeslægtede danske kollega Stine Spitsberg, a.k.a. Stinestregen.
Og i den orden.
Lige præcis. Og i den serie er der udkommet 4 bind, mm-hmm. And there's a 5th coming this October.
Yes, and the title is actually a callback. It's going to be called Adulthood is a Gift, because I'm in my 30s now.
Growing up.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah. So it's the fifth book, and it's coming out like over a decade after the first strips were published online. So it's kind of a reflection on my career.
And we should say these are basically collections of the strips you've published online.
Yes. And then I usually do at least 20 new ones for the books. And some of them also have writings. And Adulthood as a Gift has 15 essays, which is going to be a collection of reflections on my career.
Great. And so presumably you got the book deal because you were having some popular success online. I mean, I think these things follow. But it still felt like a real thing when you had a book deal. That's sort of slightly old-fashioned, maybe. I don't know. Like, how do you sort of think about that now?
Yeah, now I don't feel like you need a book to be successful. And I actually think certain forms of online income are actually way more reliable than traditional book publishing. But I think that was far back enough where everyone I was referencing was a newspaper cartoonist or had been published in some way. So to me, it was this big pillar of success, whereas now I don't think it's so much the case.
Right. And we should maybe say something about the strip. I mean, it is in some ways very much like a classic newspaper strip, but it uses sort of an avatar that is kind of you.
Yes.
Sort of.
Is it autofiction?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Especially in the beginning.
Right.
And yeah, it was in the beginning, it was almost like a diary.
Yeah.
Because
Which is one of the like the great formats for social media cartooning.
Yes.
Is the diary form.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most popular formats, and you're a pioneer in this in some ways. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there are others around, but it's incredible how it's grown, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It is.
How quickly did you experience the growth in readership that you had?
So it was a slow process that took basically the entire time I was at art school. I think early on, I had like one comic go really viral, and I felt that just gave me some fire. I wanted to replicate it, but it took a long time before I understood why things go viral and what's funny. And I really got lucky right there at the beginning, and that gave me the encouragement to keep going. So it was years, I think, before I had an audience reliable enough to, for example, put out a book. And I was very, very lucky because I was in art school, so I had that safety net, you know, so I was experimenting in different styles. I wasn't trying to squeeze out comics after my 9-to-5. I really had a cushion of teachers and classes behind me. So I was truly, truly fortunate.
But the publisher understood that you were bringing a big audience to them.
Yes. Yeah. Even back then, that was part of it. And it is still a huge part of it today. It's actually way more important today that they look for certain numbers before they publish, especially if it's a webcomic. And I don't fully agree with that, because there are artists I follow that I know there's something special about their work. They're maybe just beginning. But if I were a publisher, I would say, absolutely, give this guy a deal. Let's make some amazing work. But they're looking for, I think, if I had to guess, I think they're looking for on Instagram like around 250,000 for a book deal. And to me, that's, like I said, I find it excessive, but it's unfortunately a big part of it.
Yeah. And it is difficult, I imagine, even with 250,000 followers, to make a living.
Yes.
On its own, just like that. Or if you have 100,000, I mean, which sounds like a lot, but you know, it's a big audience. It's much more than
it's not monetized by automatician. You have to do something else to fully deploy the numbers of followers.
Yes, absolutely. It's a huge challenge, because I think like YouTubers, for example, they get paid just to make content. And I always think about, like, God, with the numbers I am able to reach, if I just got paid for that, I could probably make a living, but none of these platforms do that. So cartoonists and illustrators, they make money in a very varied method of ways. And for me, I just do a million different things. Like, I do prints, I do books, I have Patreon. I do a lot of little freelance gigs because I also work as an illustrator. So it's, when people ask, I always say, just do everything. everything you can, diversify. You never know if Patreon is going to vanish tomorrow and you're back right. to doing conventions or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it would be really interesting to hear you talk a little about your craft, the discipline of making a cartoon, a strip, a whatever this is. Cartoonist often talks about cartooning as a number of disciplines in one, and your reflections and I mean the effort you make to make a strip. Before we did the recording, we talked a little about making something very, very complicated look simple.
Yes.
So well, how do you consider the craft of cartooning? Your craft.
Well, having studied illustration, I actually think cartooning is harder. And I think people would see my style and say, how on earth could you say that when you're drawing barely above a stick figure? But the idea, the writing behind it is what makes it work, at least for my style of cartooning. There's so many different art styles, but for me, it's the idea, getting that idea to work in four panels, making it accessible, making it look accessible online. It's very complicated. And it, the idea generation for me is the most difficult part, and it's something I spend hours, days, sometimes weeks on. Sometimes there's a flow and it's easy, but...
What's your frequency of publication?
Twice a week. Right.
So, but when I read your comics, it's like your cartoons, it's like, obviously there's text, there's sequence, there's the characters, the illustrations, but there's also the directing of acting, you could say.
Yeah.
And you do a lot where it's the combination of all things that actually makes it funny.
Yeah.
Especially your alter ego characters, giggling eyes.
Yeah.
That somehow often expresses the opposite of what she's saying.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's exactly like you said. It's everything coming together. And I think simple cartooning styles can be deceptive because you don't have a lot of lines and information to make something really hit. So sometimes a simple drawing can actually be more complex in that way because you need it to express what you want it to express, and you only have so much bandwidth on the page. You need to make the eyes look a certain way. So it's exactly like you said, it's a bunch of different small sets of skills coming together.
So when you have a frequency of two strips a week, how, I figure it must be, you must have different processes. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard. Mm-hmm. But when it's hard, What are your struggles? What is it you're dealing with? What are your frustrations?
It's almost always, I noticed that my art blocks come from being overwhelmed. So I mentioned at the beginning that I have different series and that I'm often doing freelance work and working on things for Patreon. And sometimes, so even though two strips a week doesn't sound like a lot, there's a lot happening behind the scenes. And I notice when things pile up and I start like clenching my jaw a little when I'm working, I just notice things don't flow. So as I've gotten older, I've realized that art blocks come from an external place. And a lot of creative people think, oh my gosh, it's my fault. My creativity is dead. It's over. But I've found that's not true, and that I usually just need to move things around in my personal life or my work life. So in that case, it's honestly just taking a small break, but it's challenging because it's your job, so you want to keep that creative flow,
right? And so moving to the promised discussion about mm-hmm. AI before we go to the case, the plaintiff. Mm-hmm. So one day, mm-hmm. you had a particular experience with AI and your work. What was that, and mm-hmm. what happened?
So it was October 2022, and I had heard something was happening with this thing called AI, and I had not investigated it because someone had stolen my work to make NFTs, and I had been in a whole separate battle with that. So I was like, sounds like they're copying stuff over in the AI world. I can't deal with this right now. Somebody tagged me, and they said, I forget exactly what they said, but it was very clear this is, they used my name as a prompt. And just that really shocked me that that concept was already possible. I felt very shocked and violated.
You simply saw a Sarah Scribble cartoon that you hadn't done yourself, with text, with illustrations, with sequence, with all the things. It didn't exactly look like your style, but it was close.
It was not a comic, so someone had tagged me, and okay. it was an illustration. It was a black and white illustration. It was like a person with an umbrella,
right?
And to me, it looked kind of like my work, and it was more the concept that it was possible to use my name and then have something appear. So that began the whole saga.
You've mentioned you had your work appropriated earlier,
yes,
by like extreme right wing people on the internet.
Yes.
Changing the text.
Yeah.
So you already had some experience of having your work appropriated.
Yes.
How was this different?
It was, well, what happened with the right wing incident was that it was a targeted harassment campaign. So the person that had been experimenting with AI was not part of that. I don't think that person understood that it would be an offense to me. They were just playing around. So the intentions were different.
Right.
But there was this element of something that was mine being twisted for a purpose that I didn't stand behind, mm, that elicited a bit of a similar reaction.
Yeah, you wrote an op-ed for the New York Times where you describe it very poetically, actually, like that it's almost as if a shadow self,
yes,
is out there. I don't know whether you... It
sounds childhood like something from Marvel Comics.
No, Hans Christian Andersen. Is it Skuggen?
Yeah. I didn't even think of that. But yeah, that is kind of poetic.
No, yeah. Salman Rushdie evokes this in his recent interview about his new book, about
right,
being attacked.
Yes.
That's mm-hmm a digression. Yeah. He evokes that story. Anyway, it sounds like that, you know, yeah, that there's a different self out there that's not you, that seems recognizable, but is not you.
Yeah, and this is something I feel broad spectrum about AI. For example, for me, my work is very personal. So if someone is using my work to advocate for far-right extremist ideas, that is very painful and offensive to me. But also smaller scale, I try to ask people to imagine, what if somebody made a deepfake of themselves talking about an idea or a concept that they did not at all approve of, or their voice, which those things are now possible. I think back then it wasn't as prevalent. But for me, art is that personal. So having the experience with these right-wing lunatics gave me that feeling of this loss of control and this pain of being associated with something I would never want to be associated with. And AI gives me a similar feeling, because if there are no guardrails or restrictions, you can take my name and my work. And in theory, with other types of AI, you can take my face or my voice, yeah, and have me stand for something that I don't agree with.
Yeah. And it is also a case, I know one of your co-plaintiffs, Greg Rutkowski, who's a fantasy illustrator, when you search his name now, you're much more liable to get an AI image than an image that he actually created.
Yes, exactly. And so that's not the case for me, fortunately, but for him, I can only imagine what he feels. He's an incredibly talented concept artist, and his style is very recognizable. And I can only imagine how much work went into creating his portfolio. And now when you Google him, it's not even his work. It's a cheap imitation.
Yeah, I mean, he's been used tens of thousands of times for prompts or something. There's like, you can count the prompts or something,
yeah,
in these models that create the images.
Yeah.
So he's like one of the most replicated, or whatever however you want to describe it.
Yeah.
So, but it means like there's this feeling of your art being stolen, that like somebody else is making your art in a way. That's I can imagine, like if a search brings up something you haven't made and it's in your name and on a very large scale, it is like something disappears. Like there's a disconnect,
yeah,
between that's what you, oh, this shadow self, I sort of return to that, this idea that there's another you out there, which is sort of warped and a persona that you can't control.
Exactly. It's like my work is out there, but I'm removed from it.
Yeah.
And so it can go in all sorts of different directions that I don't want it to go in as the original artist.
Should we perhaps summarize what these models do, these generative models that...
Please go ahead.
That your lawsuit is about, like, mm-hmm. How is it that they work? Mm-hmm. As I understand it, I mean, we have to talk about Stable Diffusion or Midjourney or whatever they're called. That they use these data sets that they scrape from the internet.
Yes.
Without any, I mean, it seems like they can just freely do that. That's the issue, and then they use those to as reference to create through. A neural
source
network
material.
Process. Yeah, it's source material to create these images.
Yes.
How is your understanding of it?
Yes. So basically, they do not work without huge sums of data. I believe the data set Lion 5B, the one that is the basis for I believe most of Stable Diffusion, it's 6 billion images. So you can imagine there's all kinds of stuff in there. I don't know if we have time to get into all the details, but a lot of people have raised issue not just with the fact that there is a lot of copyrighted material, but there is also images of, for example, revenge porn. And Stanford released a study that showed that there is child sex abuse material. So these data sets, they're not well filtered. They're just massive. And that's most AI has to work off of huge swaths of data, or else it just doesn't work as good. And then basically how the programs work is just you type in a prompt and it uses that data and how it has learned from it to create a new image. So that is a very, very simple version, but in my view, it's kind of like a big data machine.
Right. Yeah. And you filed this lawsuit in January of 2023, is that right?
Yes.
With a couple of co-plaintiffs.
Yes.
Can you explain something? What made you go there? Like, what made you decide to do that, and how did it happen?
Yeah, I think it was clear, based on how these programs were rolled out, that they never worked with artists, and we found it essentially impossible that they would listen to us and that they would voluntarily work with us to create some kind of consent or royalty system. So we felt the lawsuit was
Had you been
necessary.
In touch with some of these companies?
I had not. I know there had been back and forths on Twitter with other artists, but no, I had not personally been in touch with them.
Right.
But it was you and Kelly McKernan?
Yes.
And Carla Ortiz?
Yes.
You, the three of you, who made this case in the first place?
Yes.
And how did you decide that?
It's
a big deal. Saying we are three girls, we wanna take it over and make the big tech companies listen.
Yeah. Well, it's intimidating when you think about it. Carla is a very vocal and incredibly smart artist and advocate. She's really the ringleader. And I believe she testified in front of Congress. So she has guts. And I had faith in our law firm because they were, Carla had been looking around for a long time to find a law firm that would represent us. And AI was so new and still is so new that a lot of law firms don't really know how to deal with it. It's really hard for the average person to even wrap their mind around how it works. So our law firm, Joseph Saveri, they had filed previously a separate lawsuit, the GitHub Copilot case, which is a coding AI case. So they had already taken that step before we were on the scene. And then generative image AI came out and we felt like they were a good fit. But yeah, it... when you hearing you say it back, it is like, oh wow, we really did that. And now we're joined, we are joined by 7 more plaintiffs.
So you're all in all 10 people.
Yes.
But
yes.
It's a so-called class action lawsuit, which we should probably also explain. Mm-hmm. So as I understood that, and I'm not a lawyer, especially not an American lawyer, but it is a lawsuit that is filed on the basis of an entire class of, in this case, artists.
Exactly.
So you represent by this lawsuit a greater group of people in a way.
Exactly. Yes.
In the abstract, it's not that they've all signed onto it, but that's how it works, isn't it?
Yes.
That whatever outcome is from the lawsuit, it will benefit or not the entire group. Is that how it works? Is that the?
Yes, I believe so. And because the results are going to inevitably impact the illustration.
Yeah. So it's sort of on behalf of a group that it's done, and it's filed in the Northern District of California, which I imagine is because that's where the companies are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in also in that breath, I mean, it goes without saying, but this is a case of great principle, but also practical importance.
Yes.
I mean, the outcome of this case could be really, really important.
Yes.
Can you stress that a bit?
Yes. So what we are really looking for in this case is what we call the three C's: credit, consent, and compensation. Some people are now adding a T, transparency. And those are things that the art world has not gotten from generative AI. And it's what we need to work and live in a world in which generative AI exists. So if, for example, if you're Greg Rutkowski and everyone is using your name and your previous body of work to create new work, why hire Greg Rutkowski?
Right.
Why not just pay for one of the image generators to create his work? So that is part of why our copyright is so important, is because in this case, now with generative AI on the scene, it's our livelihood. So I can't stress how deeply important it is.
And in the US already, a lot of concept artists especially has been laid off.
Yes.
That's always severe consequences.
I believe that, I don't have exact numbers behind me, but I believe that concept artists are the first to be hit, because for me, a cartoonist, you need a combination of writing and you need to copy my style. So maybe you need ChatGPT too. Concept artists.
Two AIs.
Yeah, two AIs. It's a bit slightly more nuanced. But concept artists, right from the get-go, once these AI generators came out, it's very, very easy to see how you can take a concept artist's work, who they usually have their entire portfolio online to begin with, and then create new work using their name and their portfolio. So I believe they were hit pretty fast and pretty hard.
Can you explain the main complaints in the lawsuit?
Sure.
What is it that you're, you know, like, what are the contents of the lawsuit?
Sure. I have my notes here. Okay. So in the original claim, we claimed direct copyright infringement, vicarious copyright infringement, violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, violation of statutory and common law right of publicity, unfair competition, and breach of contract.
Okay. And in summary?
In summary, we're saying you stole our work. In summary, it's a copyright case.
Yes, right. And what are you seeking to gain from the lawsuit?
So I'll talk a little bit about the status first. So one count that we know for sure that is moving forward.
Yes, because there was a setback in October, right?
Yes.
The judge sided with the defendants.
Yes. So maybe I'll explain that, and then I'll go into what we're looking for. So most of the case was dismissed, but there is a caveat there. It was dismissed with ability to amend. So the judge said we can file again. So we took his notes and we filed an amended complaint in November, and we will hear an answer about whether we are moving forward with that on May 8th. However, there was one count that was not dismissed that we know is moving forward, and that was against Stability AI for copying 16 of my works that were registered with the Copyright Office. The other two artists at the time, their works were not registered, so that's why that count is just moving forward on behalf of me. And what we are looking for is basically to retain our copyright and licensing rights. So, and we want that to extend to generative AI. So like I said, credit, consent, and compensation, we want to be able to say whether or not our works can be used by generative AI. We want credit and compensation. So if our works are used, we want some sort of royalty program, and we want credit. And then, of course, the T that some people add, transparency, that we want to know more about the data sets. Some generators are not as transparent with their data sets. We want to know what's going in, how they're built, and because it's important to.
I mean, this is one of the big problems with AI, isn't it? Yeah. It's like, how is it actually made? And,
yes.
And that's becoming increasingly difficult to figure out. And sometimes they don't even know themselves.
Yeah. Like, yes.
I mean, well, a lot of the time they don't know, because it's a neural network that teaches itself new things.
Exactly.
To reverse engineer what it's done is, I think, impossible in some sort. At least they haven't figured out a way to do it.
Exactly, and that is why when it's not as easy as just taking our works out, you would have to remake the model with a new data set that does not include copyrighted
works.
Because
it's already there.
Yes, yeah. So that's why they're finding us.
yeah. And they also just talk about watermarking mm-hmm. AI-generated content. This is one of the regulatory suggestions, or I think it's, I mean, that's one of the, if one wants to regulate it, it was like, so you can identify that this is made by AI, especially you mentioned deepfakes earlier.
Yes.
That you can easily identify something that's made by AI, but that's probably beyond what you're seeking here, but that is part of this transparency argument, isn't it?
Yes, that we're not asking for that in specifically in the trial, but I personally would love to see that.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So if something appears that looks like your cartoons, you can immediately tell by looking into the code or whatever, I don't know, but there's a watermark saying this is not you. This is actually like a machine.
Precisely.
But you were moving towards Matthias's question in terms of what you seek to achieve to get out of this.
Yeah.
And you were explaining.
Yes, it's the credit, consent, and compensation idea. And in theory, we might get damages, but our goal is really to set a precedent for how these companies use our work, use artists' work, and work that is copyrighted.
In your case, mm-hmm. in a perfect dream world, mm-hmm. what would that look like?
Well, that would look like them asking for my permission first instead of just taking my work. They have this argument that it's publicly available work. But coming from the art world and with our licensing norms, publicly available does not mean public domain.
No.
Right? So
still copyrighted material.
Yes, so I would like to see our licensing norms applied to the tech world, because we've been around, the art world has been around for a while.
Would that be royalties, compensation in terms of money? What mm-hmm. that part of it, what, how could mm-hmm. that look?
Yeah, so for example, if you were an artist and you consented to having your work be trained in one of these models, then you would then in theory have right to compensation. And that would probably, I can't predict the future or say exactly how it would look, but people have compared it to Spotify. So you would get a little bit of money every time your work is used, potentially.
Yeah, right. A tiny amount in the case of Spotify. That's another issue. Yeah.
A bag of candy.
As I understood, the dismissal, the initial dismissal of the mm-hmm. case included formulations that, which is what the defendants have argued, is mm-hmm. that these are not, this is not plagiarism. Mm-hmm. They haven't copied an existing artwork. They've mm-hmm. transformed, they've taken something that they've transformed mm-hmm. into a new artwork. How do you respond to that? Because it seemed like the judge mm-hmm. sided with that argument mm-hmm. in the first instance.
Yeah, so we won't know exactly what his ruling is until he rules on the amended complaint. But essentially, the reason I don't agree with that, and we don't fully have the information yet, but our side believes that the images are compressed. And that's important because that means that the images are still there and being used. And the CEO...
Your images.
Yes, yeah. The CEO of Stability AI has said that it uses a compression system. It's very complicated and it's a bit hard for me as an artist.
Is that the guy who was fired recently?
Yes. Yeah.
The Stability AI is not very stable at the moment.
Right.
They cut 20% of their staff and like it was a big shakeup. Anyway.
Yeah, there's stuff happening there. It's very interesting to see. But
derailed a bit.
Oh, no. Okay, I've got it. So there's this idea of, does it learn from the images and then forget them? Or is it compressed and it's always sort of using this compressed data? And it's
so very stored in a way.
Yes.
Somewhere.
Yes. And
in its memory, if nothing else, in its like that it's present somewhere in its virtual memory or
Yeah. And so it's a bit tough for me as an artist to fully understand, but that distinction would theoretically be important, that if they're compressing the images, they are using them without
continually.
And without a license, and therein lies an issue.
Could you make the analogy that it's a little bit like if we've seen an image, we've memorized it, and it's part of our, as an artist, you know, you internalize something, there's something that you're inspired by. You get
heavily inspired.
Yeah, and it's somewhere in your, you know, your artistic spirit, you know, whatever, your artistic memory. It's part of your image bank in a way. We use these analogies of computers always to talk about our brain and our consciousness, which is maybe not the best way. But could you make the analogy there that it's because the model has already learned from your image, and therefore it's still using it?
Well, I think you could maybe say that instead of learning like a human, where it's like you would have a fuzzy memory of an image, in my belief, AI is more like a system that has the ability to have billions of filing cabinets, so it can pull out individual images. So its quote unquote memory is very different from how a human remembers.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And some of the argument is over that.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And that leads me to also the fair use argument, which I think we were starting to get at. So
yes.
So in the United States, fair use is not as simple as if you transform an image a bit, then that's fair use. In fact, I have my notes again. There are four tenets to fair use, and that is the purpose and character of your use, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the portion taken, and the effect of the use upon the potential market. And for me, that last one is really important. I'll go back to Greg Rutkowski. Why hire him if you can use AI and you can use, and his existing portfolio has been used to help create this generative system, and now it can do what he does. So that last, for me personally, I don't know how it will play out legally, but that last point in the US fair use tenets is the most important. But also, you know, the other one that always stands out to me is the amount and substantiality of the portion taken. For a lot of these artists, their entire portfolio is in there. Or
everything that's publicly available has been scraped. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, to me, it's just not as simple as, well, they changed the images a bit.
And,
it's more complicated.
How does it compare to sampling? Like, because we, of course, there's been a history of the music industry trying to like stop sampling of music.
Yeah. I don't know too much about it, but what I would say is, from my understanding, sampling was an issue and there had to be a royalty compensation system set in place because of that. So,
but it's something artists have argued against, this royalty system.
Yeah.
They have to pay royalties on something they've transformed profoundly.
Okay.
I know this is a computer and we're talking about real people here. It's a very different, artists creating something new and here's a computer creating something
new. Right. But I think on a more simple level, I think it's true that, in terms of sampling, the solution was a royalty system, a compensation system. Mm-hmm. And for instance, on Beyoncé's new album, I think there's a billion samples and she's paying.
But the problem is that that's a barrier to creativity. So the argument, I'm trying to come at you with some of the counter arguments here, that this would stifle creativity on the internet if you look at AI as a creative tool. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that more sort of fuzzy kind of argument?
The thing is that AI is a tool that it works off of these artists' portfolios. So it's just, it feels different to me than a person making an individual piece and making something new. I actually don't think that generative AI is very creative, because for us artists, we have trained our whole lives to learn how to draw, learn how to use Photoshop and Procreate. And I don't know that there's really a true artistic process behind generative AI. Maybe that's not so much a legal argument.
No, but that's just what's interesting.
How I personally feel is that when, you know, when people say, well, I can't draw, so I want to use generative AI. I've heard people say back, well, babies draw. Everyone can draw. And I think barriers to creativity, I don't think generative AI is the answer to barriers to creativity.
But couldn't you imagine somebody using AI very creatively? I think there are already artists using it, of course. I mean, we've yet to see the potential creatively of using this kind of technology.
Yeah, potentially. The problem would be that those projects would then put artists who have worked their whole lives out of a job. So if we're going to implement it in any kind of large scale, I would say we need guardrails. We need to protect the artists whose work went into building it in the first place. So yeah, I can, you know, I'm not for totally banning it because I can see how it can be useful, but I just think it's unfair to the labor of artists to unleash it on the world and say, this is how art works now, and to not consider the artists whose labor went into it.
And the difference between the sampling analog that I used before, of course, is also that, and you explained this in the complaint, that there are people making money off of this. It's not like it's just out, it's called OpenAI, it's out there for free, but the companies are making a lot of money off this.
Yes.
Not the artist. I mean, that's also a component, isn't it? I mean, there's somebody's actually making money. If it was just a charity and nobody was making money, it would be probably different, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and not only are they making a lot of money, so it becomes sort of almost a labor rights issue because they're making money off of our labor, our portfolios, and we're not seeing a dime. And then there's the added component of if there are no guardrails, then it can potentially put us out of business. So it's a twofold financial issue.
The further argument, and I'll stop this barrage of, argument soon, but the further argument is that if you were to implement what you wish to do, you would shut down the freedom of the internet, basically. And if you like the free flow of information on the internet, if everything had to be controlled in terms of royalties and watermarking and what all these things, you would. I mean, this is the argument I hear against this kind of thing, that the internet as a free form of ideas and of content would be basically be impossible.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what like freedom of internet means?
Yeah. I mean, it is complicated, but I think the idea, as I understand the argument, is that if a company, an AI company, in this case, wants to create these models, and the models have to develop and learn and whatever. They need information. And they need, as you said, billions of images. They really need a lot of information.
Yeah.
If every single image used had to be traced and you had to like write out a royalty check to that person, it would become bureaucratically become impossible to do any of it. It would be the models would no longer be able, you would not be able to develop them. And then you could say, okay, no big loss. We don't want these models out there, if that's your point. But the greater logic of the internet is dependent on that kind of access to information. I don't know what, I mean, I don't know where I stand on this, but I do see it as it is an argument about, in a more abstract sense, about the freedom of information.
Yeah. Well, I would say, for me, it is more important to protect the data and the copyright and the fairness of what is being used to make this internet freedom machine. So I'll take it a little bit away from art and say the cost of some of these generative AI systems is not just our art. It's also people's faces and their likenesses. And in other forms of AI, their voice or the way they write. And to me, there has to be a fair trade-off first. There has to be safety. There has to be guardrails. There has to be regulation to protect our data and our safety. And in our copyright case, our copyright and our work and our labor before these generative AI systems are allowed to run free.
Yeah, and you compared it earlier with deepfakes. Yes. Which I think people much more easily can understand. Yeah. This is something we don't want.
Yeah, right? Like you could say, well, we want the freedom to make as many deepfakes as we want, and it's a free speech issue. And I would argue, well, people have the right to their likeness, and they have the right to safety. They have the right to not be sexualized without their consent, and they have the right for their data to be protected. Yeah. So those kinds of regulations are more important for me first.
Law, labor law is of course a massive thing, and I think especially in Northern Europe we are mostly really happy that we have this legislation, and I think it. I really hope that your case is probably the first step towards a legislation, because all the aspects you address, the it's not to sound cynical, but the money issue I think is really profound, because that has something to do with fairness and of course compensation and stuff like that. It seems like this is a pioneering case. This is a first step, and I do feel. And mostly hope, but I also think that eventually there will be legislation. Mm-hmm. And of course in Denmark we have copyright legislation, and it is also a European Union. In the US too, matter.
But it's just, this is a completely new field, right?
But Matthias, you addressed sort of the balance between freedom and fair use and all this. And for instance in Denmark, I think I'm not an expert either, but I think we have laws that actually protect you from plagiarism pretty hefty, but a lot of people don't use that legislation because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We had the thing with the Little Mermaid, the statue, that where the heirs of the artist who did it were really aggressive in filing cases towards anyone who made a picture or drawing or used it as a background still in a movie or something like that, and they really milked the copyright potential out of that. They milked it, and it was not very nice to look at.
But something that's iconic that is in some way
not public domain.
It should be. You feel that it should be public domain because it's so. But that's a different.
That's an extremity. On one hand,
extreme example.
So, we should hope for a legislation that is there and will help you if there is an issue.
Yeah.
And make sure that your concerns, Matthias, about the freedom of the internet
freedom of expression, but also the freedom to develop, like the development of technology. You know, which you can say, well, that's a double-edged sword. You know, but like it is, you know, this would impede it theoretically. It's also interesting. I mean, another thing you point out, and which is we're talking about this as being a new area that there's just very little. There's no legislation. Nobody knows. Your law firm is like one of the few law firms that would take on the case because it's so new. And it's just funny. You mention in the complaint that you have quotes from the people at these AI companies saying, use this, use the try in the style of this artist or that artist.
Yes.
You know, they actually encourage people to use, like try to prompt. That's part of the evidence brought, isn't it?
Yes, one of the more...
The impunity. It's just, they don't even think about it. They don't even think about the implications of this.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reporting about maybe not generative AI, but just reports coming out about other AI companies that, you know, there's this... Because they need so much data, they were actively behind the scenes being told to skirt ideas around licensing and copyright because they need so much information. So it was just too much of a hassle for them, I guess. And one of the more, I guess, notorious pieces of evidence in our case is that in 2022, David Holtz, the CEO of Midjourney, publicly released an artist's names list. It's not just artist names. I think there's also things like styles, but it was 4,000 artists. And we produced that piece of evidence in...
Which 4,000 names as references, source material for generative AI images.
Exactly. And we had released it in November, but then I think it was January or February, someone shared it on Twitter or X. And I think there was something very personal to artists about some of them seeing their name on the list that really shocked them, because these generative AI systems, they really are hard to understand. And there's things we don't know. And especially as an artist, someone that doesn't have a STEM background, it's quite challenging. So I think a lot of artists were understanding that something was happening with AI, but then seeing that their names might be used was really personal and shocking, maybe brings us back to that initial moment of shock that I had when someone first tagged me and used my name.
So this is the CEO publishing a list of artists that they whose work is in the data set.
I assume it must
how
be.
How does it
in
work?
The, yeah. Yeah, I assume if he published it.
Presumably there are more than 4,000 artists.
Yes. Let's see. There was, I believe there was another one, or maybe the same one, 4,700. But it was essentially, I think it was just for people to reference and to use in their prompts. And so you would assume that if their names are on this list, then their work is almost certainly in the data sets that they use to train as well.
So we'll provide a link to that in our...
Yeah, it's interesting. Search for your name.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. You could like hunt through it to find your name there.
So what is the status right now with the case? What's happening?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, so certain parts of the case were dismissed, but with ability to amend. So we had filed our amended new complaint with brushed up arguments and new plaintiffs back in November. And we will hear...
From 44 pages to 90 pages.
It got bigger. And we will hear back on May 8th. So in a few days, I'm actually flying out to be present at the hearing. I won't be speaking or anything, but we're very curious to know what happens. And then we do know that one count will go forward. So the judge will decide and we will...
Right, so this is very much a to-be-continued podcast because there really is a something will happen in a week's time.
Yes.
What do you think will happen?
Well, what I hope will happen is that the judge looks obvious. At it and is like, you guys are geniuses.
Yes, yes, here's your money, run.
What I think will happen, it is very, very hard to say what I think will happen because I don't think... I believe we are the first generative AI case. So there's no real precedent to look back on. And
are there other cases on a similar going on now?
Yes, Getty Images also filed a lawsuit, I believe, against Stability. I'm not sure who exactly they
That's
filed
an image
against.
Resource where you can purchase
stock
images,
photos.
Stock photos.
Yes,
yes. Yeah. And they're coming...
You understand why.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, because they want their licensing rights for that. So yes, so I don't know if there are any others against generative AI. Against OpenAI, the ChatGPT, there's like 20.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And there's Sarah Silverman, George R. R. Martin, New York Times, right. Authors Guild. I believe that's the George R. R. Martin case. There's a lot. So but to my knowledge, I believe it's against generative image AI. There is us and Getty Images. And it is really hard to say what will happen because there is not much precedent at all.
So if it fares well for you on the 8th of May, mm-hmm. what will follow? What are the likely scenarios? I mean, it's not over no matter what happens.
Right, exactly. So what will happen is... We have, the last 16 months or so, we've been working through motions to dismiss. So the case has not yet been thrown out. So we know whether or not it moves forward on May 8th. And on May 8th, if we succeed, we will almost certainly go into what's called discovery, which is where both sides ask for information. So we are then allowed to sort of dig into Stability and these other companies. And we really hope for that because that might give us some answers, especially in regards to issues like the compression issue. We want to know more information about that. Mm. I think some of these questions are a bit hard to answer because they are not unclear. So I guess that kind of answers your earlier question. If I can hope for something, is that I do hope we move into discovery so that we can start gathering more information.
Actually, the one thing I did want to hear about, but this is different. Mm-hmm. It's about... And this is when we're back at the beginning of the discussion. I don't know whether it's useful at all to just, but I'd like to hear about these platforms.
Uh-huh.
You know, because we've had several episodes where we talked about Webtoon and Tapas and so on.
Uh-huh.
Like, you say none of these platforms can make you, like, there's not no way of making a living through the use of these platforms. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a compensation model in Tapas, Webtoon, those kinds of platforms? And do you see any perspective in that? Is there anything promising there for mm-hmm. cartoonists in terms of making a living off their mm-hmm. cartooning and publishing it, just publishing it mm-hmm. online?
I would certainly say it's promising. Right now, just publishing my comic on Tapas and Webtoon is not at all sustainable for a living. I don't know the exact details, but I know they sometimes do like digital exclusivity contracts. And I don't know how much I can speak on it because I know Webtoon has had some controversy lately, but I haven't looked into the exact details. So right now, I don't know that it's livable, but I would say this idea of paying artists for exclusive digital rights to display the work online is a great idea, because that is usually a much better compensation system than ad revenue. Right now, I just get ad revenue and it's not livable. Negligible. It's pennies. Yeah. Yeah.
And you could also fear that it would turn into a Spotify where you basically compensated nothing, even though a little bit, but it's like such a small fraction of
yes.
of what you would make if it were published physically.
Right. Right now, for me, the most lucrative platform is Patreon, because Patreon I kind of like because you can customize and you can set certain monetary tiers and you can decide what level of work you're doing. I know some artists publish almost exclusively on Patreon, but in terms of your original question, I definitely do see potential for online platforms to work towards compensating artists, but I don't really think it's gotten there yet.
Right. I mean, I don't know whether this is a bit of an indiscreet mm-hmm. question, but I would like to give the listeners a sense of somebody mm-hmm. who has the number of followers mm-hmm. that you have. How comfortably can you live off your cartooning?
Right now, I can live comfortably, but I jump from thing to thing. So if I could potentially give some advice, it would be for artists to diversify. So do Patreon if you can. Do books, do merchandise, do prints. Take freelance commissions, do freelance work. Because I have found in my career one thing to be very lucrative and then vanish the next day. Yeah. So I am comfortable, but I think I will always have a little bit of this idea in my mind that one thing could fall out from under me and that it's necessary for me to have my eyes on a lot of different projects and streams.
And you're not living in a big mansion.
No, no, I am not. I'm living in a nice apartment, but right. not a big mansion.
Right. No, no, but it's just interesting. I mean, I think Charles Schulz, for example, mm-hmm. who's the one of the grandfathers of your style, you know, like he lived in a very comfortably, you know,
yeah.
back then it was possible
yes.
as a cartoonist with a maybe even greater readership, but it's a readership of that magnitude, you know.
Yeah.
And I think he was also at some point top 10 rich person in the United
US.
States.
Yeah, yeah, yes. yeah. I mean, it was merchandise, of course, most.
The good old days.
Yeah. Okay.
Merchandising. What about merchandising?
Yeah, I do merchandising. Yeah, but I am not anywhere near that. I don't. If anyone wants to get rich off of comics, just don't try.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, yeah, that's, thank you. I mean, I know it's a bit indiscreet, but it's mm-hmm. I think this is interesting for people to hear, you know.
And to conclude this session, I will switch to Danish again.
Okay.
Og spørge dig, Sarah, om når du lige har forklaret din trængsler med at sørge for at tjene til dagen og vejen, og at det måske, selvom at du har over 4 millioner følgere, at måske husker man dig om 200 år som den person, der lavede de første love om en ny tids teknologi. Oh. Er det noget, du har overvejet, at det faktisk er meget betydningsfuldt?
Jeg har tænkt på det, fordi navn af the case, det er Anderson versus Stability AI. Så hvis vi taber eller hvis vi vinder, så er det min navn.
Der altid vil blive nævnt.
Ja, fordi det er min A. Så det tænker jeg.
Hvordan kan det egentlig være, det er dit navn?
Fordi det starter med en A. Så det er den første.
Det er alfabetet. Hvor er det smart.
Ja, så jeg er ikke special. Men ja, det har jeg tænker på det meget, og for det der håber jeg, at vi vinder. Ja.
Tusind tak, fordi du kom og lagde vejen forbi vores studie og fortalte om den her sag, som Vi har tænkt os at følge op på, når det bliver den 8. maj, og der kommer nyt i sagen.
Ja, fantastisk. Mange tak. Ja. Mange tak.
Og husk, at du kan altid høre masser af udsendelser fra vores bagkatalog. Måske især den anden udsendelse, vi har lavet om AI, som du kan finde på SoundCloud og alle de andre platforme.
Lavet dengang Midjourney og alt det andet var i sin barndom.
Lige præcis. Og følg os på Instagram, som også er Sarah Andersens medie, hvor du også kan følge Sarah.
Ja, Sarah Anderson Comics.
Right. Ja. Tak.